Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 135. It's Monday, October 18th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, last week I missed my first show due to being sick in over 2.5 years. And you COVID-19 vaccine hesitant deniers or whatever may like the fact that I actually missed that episode because I was taken down by a vaccine. It wasn't the COVID-19 vaccine, but it was my second dose of the shingles vaccine. The first dose, it kind of wiped me out about 50%. A little bit of a fever, a little bit of a headache for about a day or so. And that totally caught me by surprise. I hadn't really planned for it. So the second dose, I took a day earlier, but it actually took me out for about 2.5 solid days with a real wicked headache that really made it unable to really do anything. And that happens in about 1 out of 6 people who take the shingles vaccine. Interferes with their daily activities. I just want to raise this is because I want to take this as a mini little case study, a personal example, and try to expand that to, you know, vaccines do have side effects, but in my personal opinion, and from the scientific literature, it's pretty clear that you're betting against the house if you decide to avoid effective vaccines. And shingles is a good example. If you're not vaccinated for shingles, you have about a 1 in 3 chance lifetime of getting shingles. And between 10 and 18% of those people that get shingles get a long-term peripheral neural disease that is really painful that can last for months or years. So I would actually say that if 1 in 6 people had the experience that I had, even though I didn't like having it personally, it was a good bet. In fact, I would even personally take that bet of that lost few days of work in order to avoid the chances of getting a long-term side effect from shingles. I mean, shingles is really bad when it's happening, the acute phase, which can last for weeks, but the longer-term peripheral nerve damage can be very serious and last long-term. And that's ultimately what we're really trying to avoid with the shingles vaccine. Well, folks, sometimes it's hard to take our personal experience and make it jive with larger scale experimental data, but this is just one example. I'll share with you how I happen to do that. But of course, a lot of people take negative personal experiences and try to jack them up to some kind of conspiracy theory. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, folks, well, let's turn to the Lucas County local COVID-19 update. The bottom line is Lucas County is still in the thick of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our average daily cases over the last couple weeks did go down a bit. I haven't reported in 2 weeks, so it went from 207 average cases identified to date down to 162, so that's good. Although I would point out that still all 88 Ohio counties are in the high transmission rate, and we are the only state in the union where all of our counties are classified as a sustained hotspot. That is, communities that have had a high sustained case burden and may be at higher risk for experiencing healthcare resource limitations. Our testing positivity rate is still high. The proportion of those people that get tested that test positive is at 13.6%, way above the 5% benchmark, 5% or less that we seek. That is down a percentage point from 14.6% a couple weeks ago, so it's going down slowly. That's a good trend. We're higher than the state, which is now at 10.6% for testing positivity. Volume of testing is going down both locally and in Ohio. Okay, well, turning to long-term care facilities or nursing homes in Lucas County, we had 41 active cases in the most recent week, 16 residents and 25 staff. That's edging down from a couple weeks ago, so a good trend. Although we did actually have a couple deaths from nursing home residents over the last couple weeks, and that is breaking a trend. We haven't had a death in nursing homes for quite a while. So even though the cases are going down, we've had some fatalities. Turning to schools, in Lucas County schools, we had 35 staff and 238 students identified COVID-19 positive in the most recent week. That's similar to the rate of what's happening in the rest of Ohio, and is trending somewhat down, slowly but steadily down from the beginning of the school year where we've had higher numbers. University of Toledo also had 37 identified COVID-19 infections. That's down from 47 a couple weeks ago. And in particularly good news, their surveillance testing, the random testing they do among hundreds of students, is they only identified one case, which was 0.1% of those tested. Way to go, UT. Well, I suspect that also we're seeing more UT students vaccinated since they're mandated to get a vaccine, have proof by November 15th, or submit to weekly testing. So hopefully that's driving some of the decrease here. Okay, but of course, Lucas County as a whole is still in the thick of it. While we're seeing Ohio hospitalizations are edging downward, they've actually gone up in Lucas County in the last week. We had 209 new COVID-19 hospitalizations in the most recent week. Similarly, deaths are falling nationally. We're still about 1,300 deaths each day, which is staggeringly high as a cause of death. And Lucas County actually had 27 deaths reported in the last 2 weeks, which is the highest we've had in a two-week period for a long time. So we're definitely still seeing hospitalizations and deaths in Lucas County, and of course the nation as a whole, but the trend nationally is good. But of course, the epidemics vary by region. Okay, well, let's look at those that are fully vaccinated. In the United States, we're up to 57% of the entire U.S. population has been fully vaccinated. In Ohio, we cracked the 50% mark a couple weeks ago. Now we're at 51.2%. Lucas County hasn't quite got at the 50%. We're at 49.9% of our population fully vaccinated. And unfortunately, if you're looking at the rate of people getting newly fully vaccinated, that rate is slowing down still. Of course, as more people get vaccinated, there's less and less people unvaccinated. So you have less to get vaccinated. And of course, come butting up against resistance and hesitancy as well. Okay, well, I got a couple of COVID-19 stories, and now we're going to move to non-COVID-19 news for, again, a record short COVID-19 news cycle. Okay, this from Science Daily. Link between COVID vaccination and reduced household transmission, Swedish study finds. In this study, the researchers found that there was a dose-response association between the number of immune individuals in each family and the risk of infection and hospitalization in non-immune family members. Specifically, non-immune family members had a 45 to 97% lower risk of infection and hospitalization as the number of immune family members increased. So this isn't particularly surprising. If you're not vaccinated yourself, if you're surrounded by vaccinated people, you receive a lot of benefit from that. So if you don't care to get vaccinated yourself, it is beneficial to be surrounded by those people that do. And one benefit of getting vaccinated is not only does it protect you, but it protects those around you. Okay, well, the toll of COVID-19 has been staggering, and this next story gets at one of those huge costs that we've endured. This from Science Daily. New study highlights stark disparities in caregiver deaths by race and ethnicity, calls for urgent public health response. One U.S. child loses a parent or caregiver for every four COVID-19 deaths, a new study published in Pediatrics reveals. The findings illustrate orphanhood as a hidden and ongoing secondary tragedy caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, and emphasizes that identifying and caring for these children throughout their development is a necessary and urgent part of the pandemic response, both for as long as the pandemic continues, as well as into the post-pandemic era. From April 1st, 2020 through June 30th, 2021, data suggests that more than 140,000 children under age 18 in the United States lost a parent, custodial grandparent, or grandparent caregiver who provided the child's home and basic needs, including love, security, and daily care. Overall, the study shows that approximately 1 out of 500 children in the United States has experienced COVID-19-associated orphanhood or death of a grandparent caregiver. There were racial, ethnic, and geographic disparities in COVID-19-associated death of caregivers. Children of racial and ethnic minorities accounted for 65% of those who lost a primary caregiver due to the pandemic. Children's lives are permanently changed by the loss of a mother, father, or grandparent who provided their home, basic needs, and care. Loss of a parent is among the adverse childhood experiences linked to mental health problems, shorter schooling, lower self-esteem, sexual risk behaviors, an increased risk of substance abuse, suicide, violence, sexual abuse, and exploitation. There were significant racial and ethnic disparities in caregiver deaths due to COVID-19. White people represent 61% of the total U.S. population, and people of racial ethnic minorities represent 39% of the total population. Yet, study results indicate that non-Hispanic white children account for only 35% of those who lost a primary caregiver, over 51,000 children, while children of racial and ethnic minorities account for 65% of those who lost a primary caregiver, over 91,000 children. Okay, in some Ohio news, this from the Public News Service, Ohio domestic violence deaths rise 62% over 2 years. Deaths linked to domestic violence continue to rise in Ohio, according to the Ohio Domestic Violence Network's sixth annual report about incidents. Between June 1, 2020 and June 30, 2021 of this year, records show a 20% increase in domestic violence fatalities, a 62% increase from 2 years ago. Michaela Deming, policy director and staff attorney for the Ohio Domestic Violence Network, said the 131 deaths included the highest yearly number of children since they began counting. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do some environmental stories. This from CNN. Synthetic chemical in consumer products linked to early death, study finds. synthetic chemicals called phthalates found in hundreds of consumer products such as food storage containers, shampoo, makeup, perfume, and children's toys may contribute to some 91,000 to 107,000 premature deaths a year among people's age 55 to 64 in the United States, a new study found. People with the highest level of phthalates had a greater risk of death from any cause, especially cardiovascular mortality, according to the study published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Pollution. The study estimated those deaths could cost the U.S. about $40 to $47 billion each year in lost economic productivity. This study adds to the growing database of the impact of plastics on the human body and bolsters public health and business cases for reducing or eliminating the use of plastics, said lead author Dr. Leonardo Trasande, a professor of pediatrics, environmental medicine, and population health at NYU Langone Health in New York City. Phthalates are known to interfere with the body's mechanism for hormone production, known as the endocrine system, and they are linked with developmental, reproductive, brain, immune, and other problems, according to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Even small hormonal disruptions can cause significant developmental and biological effects. Chemicals and plastics damage babies' brains and must be banned immediately, expert groups say. Prior research has connected phthalates with reproductive problems, such as genital malformations and undescended testes in baby boys, and lower sperm count and testosterone levels in adult males. Previous studies have also linked phthalates to childhood obesity, asthma, cardiovascular issues, and cancer. These chemicals have a rap sheet, said Trasande, who also directs NYU's Center for the Investigation of Environmental Hazards. And the fact of the matter is that when you look at the entire body of evidence, it provides a haunting pattern of concern. Often called everywhere chemicals because they are so common, phthalates are added to consumer products such as PVC plumbing, vinyl flooring, rain and stain-resistant products, medical tubing, garden hoses, and some children's toys to make the plastic more flexible and harder to break. Other common exposures come from the use of phthalates in food packaging, detergents, clothing, furniture, and automotive plastics. Phthalates are also added to personal care items such as shampoo, soap, hairspray, and cosmetics to make fragrances last longer. People are exposed when they breathe contaminated air or eat or drink foods that came into contact with the plastic, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Children crawl around and touch many things, and then put their hands in their mouths. Because of that hand-to-mouth behavior, phthalate particles and dust might be a greater risk for children than for adults, the CDC states. The new study measured the urine concentration of phthalates in more than 5,000 adults between the ages 55 and 64, and compared those levels to the risk of early death over an average of 10 years. Researchers controlled for pre-existing heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and other common conditions, poor eating habits, physical activity, and body mass, and levels of other known hormone disruptors such as bisphenol A or BPA. But we already know phthalates mess with the male sex hormone, testosterone, which is a predictor of adult cardiovascular disease. We already know that these exposures can contribute to multiple conditions associated with mortality, such as obesity and diabetes. First, avoid plastics as much as you can. Never put plastic containers in the microwave or dishwasher, where the heat can break down the lining so they might be absorbed more readily. In addition, cooking at home and reducing your use of processed foods can reduce the level of the chemical exposures you come in contact with. Here are other tips to reduce you and your family's exposure. Use unscented lotions and laundry detergents. Use cleaning supplies without scents. Use glass, stainless steel, ceramic, or wood to hold and store foods. Buy fresh or frozen fruits and vegetables instead of canned and processed versions. Encourage frequent hand washing to remove chemicals from hands. Avoid air fresheners and all plastics labeled as number 3, number 6, or number 7. And if you didn't catch all that, you can review this. The show is recorded and available online at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Okay, and more environmental news, this from Science Daily. When the Western U.S. burns, the East also gets sick. While most of the largest U.S. wildfires occur in the Western U.S., almost three-quarters of the smoke-related deaths and visits to the emergency room for asthma occur east of the Rocky Mountains. Smoke exposure, whether from wildfires or local burning, contributes to health problems across the U.S., but the impacts vary by region. A new study finds that smoke contributes to a larger percentage of health problems in the West, but affects greater numbers of people in the East, possibly when they aren't even aware of the smoky air. The research estimates that long-term smoke exposure results in about 6,300 extra deaths each year, with the highest number occurring in the most populous states. Only 1,700 of those deaths occurred in the West. And in more environmental news, this also from Science Daily. Pollution from freight traffic disproportionately impacts communities of color across 52 U.S. cities. In urban areas across the U.S., low-income neighborhoods and communities of color experience an average of 28% more nitrogen dioxide pollution than higher-income and majority white neighborhoods. The disparity is driven primarily by proximity to trucking routes on major roadways, where diesel trucks are emitters of nitrogen dioxide and other air pollutants. Both commuter traffic and heavy-duty trucks contribute nitrogen dioxide and other pollutants, but diesel trucks are the dominant source, contributing on average up to half of a city's nitrogen dioxide, despite being at most 5% of traffic. Because diesel trucks also emit other harmful gases and particulates, changes in nitrogen dioxide are also thought to reflect exposure to other pollutants as well. Transitioning to electric heavy-duty trucks could be one way of reducing pollution exposure in neighborhoods close to highways. California already has a mandate of doing this by 2045. But while emissions from diesel trucks are the biggest driver of exposure inequality, other pollution sources contribute to the problem. Even if we eliminated emissions from trucking, we would still see inequalities present because there are other sources of inequality. Discrepancies in exposure to pollution between communities of color and white communities are well documented. They often stem from zoning practices that result in communities of color forming in less desirable areas or infrastructure like highways being built in close proximity to or through a neighborhood. Over the long term, transformative changes are needed to truly begin to remove nitrogen dioxide pollution disparity. How do you rectify the inequities that have literally been built into the environment, where certain groups are more likely to be adjacent to major roadways? A bill in the new infrastructure package is aimed at physically reconnecting communities by removing freeways as a necessary step towards equalizing air quality. Okay, well, just a good example of how our infrastructure affects our health. Okay, well, I want to end the environmental coverage I have with a kind of a funny story. Couldn't avoid this one. This from Vice.com. Scientists potty-trained cows to help reduce environmental pollution. You've heard of cow patties, but what about cow potties? As it turns out, toilet-trained cattle may become a real trend in agriculture, according to a team that taught calves to urinate in specified latrines. This so-called moo-loo training could reduce environmental pollution from cattle urine and could even help fight climate change by curbing ammonia emissions from farms. Cattle urine is a major source of ammonia emissions, which can cause environmental damage by contaminating soil and water around farms. Microbes in and around agricultural facilities also convert ammonia into nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas that contributes to human-driven climate change. Ammonia is an indirect greenhouse gas. About 95% of ammonia emissions come from agriculture, and a considerable portion comes from cattle farming, either directly from barn air or indirectly from slurry. Ammonia is responsible for a large amount of atmospheric nitrogen deposition, which in turn leads to eutrophication of the soil and water, causing soil acidification and direct plant damage. As a result of these concerns, agricultural groups around the world have been working on methods to mitigate emissions on both local and global levels. The new study shows that potty-trained cows could be a promising part of this multi-pronged approach. The success of the experiment is also both a reminder that cows are capable of learning and performing tasks that require both cognitive sophistication and physical restraint. Before writing these animals off as slow simpletons, consider that many of them can evidently learn to use the toilet at a much younger age than humans. Okay, well, let's switch it up to a more traditional long-standing health problem. This from the New York Times. FDA issues guidelines to reduce salt in foods. The Food and Drug Administration, citing an epidemic of diet-related illnesses, released new guidelines aimed at reducing the amount of salt that Americans consume at restaurants, school cafeterias, and food trucks, or when they are eating packaged and prepared foods at home. The recommendations issued after years of delay seek to reduce the average daily sodium intake by 12% over the next 2.5 years by encouraging food manufacturers, restaurants, and food service companies to scale back their use of salt. That goal translates into 3,000 milligrams of salt, slightly more than a teaspoon, compared to the 3,400 milligrams that Americans typically consume in a day. Health experts offered modest praise for the new guidance, saying it would help draw attention to the problem of excess sodium. But many expressed concern that voluntary measures might not be enough to compel change in an industry that often bridles at regulatory oversight. America's love affair with salty foods has been linked to an alarmingly high rates of high blood pressure, a leading risk factor for heart attacks, strokes, and kidney failure. More than 4 in 10 American adults have high blood pressure. Among black adults, that number is 6 in 10, the FDA said. Much of the excess sodium that Americans consume, about 70%, comes from processed and packaged food and meals served at restaurants, according to researchers. In a news conference announcing the recommendations, Dr. Janet Woodcock, the acting FDA commissioner, said they were the first step in a multi-year campaign to gradually lower the nation's sodium intake so it more closely aligns with the current dietary guidelines for Americans, which suggest a healthy diet should contain no more than 2,300 milligrams of sodium a day. I'd make an editorial comment on this. I've reported on this quite a bit before. But actually, if you look at like the Heart Association, that type of thing, and the data on mortality, probably a better recommendation than the 2,300 would be about 1,500. But the 2,300, you have to recognize that our dietary guidelines are not necessarily supposed to be the optimal health. They're kind of a compromise based on what they consider achievable on a population basis. Okay, lowering sodium intake by about 40% over a decade, the FDA said, could save 500,000 lives. Now, you'll notice that that's 40% versus the 12% they're proposing in the next 2.5. So that here they're talking more about the actual optimal levels if we were to get close to achieving that. Dr. Woodcock declined to say whether the agency would consider imposing mandatory limits on food producers should the industry fall short of the goals. Instead, she emphasized the benefits of a cooperative and incremental effort, which she said would give consumers and manufacturers time to adapt. We recognize this isn't a change that will happen overnight. It requires an iterative approach that supports gradual reductions in sodium levels broadly across the food supply over time, she said. This approach will also allow consumers' taste to adjust and result in better health outcomes. The guidance will apply to 163 categories of processed and packaged food and provide different targets for, say, rye bread, salad dressing, and baby food. The recommendations also include scores of the most common dishes served by large restaurant chains, like cheesy pasta, french fries, and tacos. Nutritionists and public health experts commended the FDA for taking on the problem of excess sodium, saying the effort would help sharpen the public's focus on the dangers of overindulgence and create pressure on food companies to reduce their reliance on salt as a cheap flavor booster. But many said that voluntary measures were unlikely to move the needle very much. Some experts have suggested mandatory reductions, though they acknowledge that the food industry's formidable lobbying power makes such measures unlikely at the federal level. This is a good start because there hasn't been much guidance on sodium reduction from the FDA in many years, but I would have preferred stronger guidance that is closer to mandatory, said Dr. Larry Appel, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research. Voluntary measures just kick the can down the road. The perils of excess sodium consumption are well documented, and public health experts have long urged federal regulators to take a more aggressive approach to reduce sodium levels in processed and prepared foods. The call to action first gained prominence at a White House conference on nutrition in 1969, followed a year later by an FDA advisory committee report, which warned that salt was unhealthy at the levels being consumed by most Americans. In the decades since, salt consumption has remained well above recommended levels, and the result has been catastrophic for public health, even more so for communities of color. Javier Becerra, the Health and Human Service Secretary and the first Latino to head the agency, sought to frame the new guidance as a way to tackle the health disparities that have become even more apparent during the coronavirus pandemic and its disproportionate toll on Black and Hispanic people. The human and economic costs of diet-related diseases are staggering, and hundreds of thousands of Americans are learning the hard way as they contract these chronic diseases and face the consequences of poor nutrition, he said. Health officials also expressed alarm about elevated sodium levels among the young and the consequences that can happen later in life. Susan Main, director of the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, said more than 95% of children 2 to 13 consume more sodium than is recommended. Eating habits, she noted, are set early in life and often persist into adulthood. This can have profound impacts on later health outcomes. Michael Jacobson, a longtime advocate for healthier diets and author of the book Salt Wars, The Battle Over the Biggest Killer in the American Diet, said he was pleased the FDA had finally acted, 5 years after the agency issued its draft guidance. But he lamented that 4 decades had passed since an FDA advisory committee first warned about the dangers of excess salt consumption. During that same time, he said, millions of Americans have perished from chronic diseases that are often preventable through dietary changes. It's just been very sad to see the government be so lackadaisical about such a serious health problem, he said. Well, this is a good example about even making small changes in our food system. And since, 70%+ of the sodium that we consume is actually coming from processed foods, it's hard for us as consumers to control that directly. But it makes a big difference if we make even incremental changes in the entire food system. So hopefully we'll see some progress on this. But hey, better than nothing. Okay, well now I wanted to do a little bit of update on the Alzheimer's drug. This from Mad in America. Alzheimer's drug controversy continues. Initially, the drug was FDA approved for everyone with Alzheimer's disease. After some outcry, the drug's label was narrowed to focus on mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia. Still, this does not exclude patients with comorbid conditions or those older than 85, both of which were exclusion criteria for the studies that the FDA claims provide evidence for the drug's efficacy. They add that the risk of dangerous adverse effects such as vascular edema and hemorrhages are likely larger in many groups of people excluded from the study. This means that for the vast majority, up to 92% of those eligible for the drug, based on the FDA's label, the efficacy and safety of the drug have not been tested, and according to the researchers, the drug is likely more dangerous in these populations as well. Finally, Aduhelm is also expensive, priced at $56,000 per year per patient, and this could incentivize doctors to prescribe it in spite of the lack of evidence for efficacy and the potential harms. Under the U.S. Medicare payment system, doctors currently receive a commission of 6% on medications they administer, which might incentivize the prescriptions of more expensive drugs and create a conflict of interest. I must admit, I had never heard that one before. That is really scary when you're talking a drug that's $56,000 per year at 6% on a commission. That would be, the doctor would rake in over $3,000. Kind of crazy, but that's the way our system works, or perhaps doesn't work.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to switch gears here a little bit and do some international news. I have reported recently that there is a new vaccine for malaria that can help reduce some of the worst outcomes of malaria, which is most predominant and most deadly on the African continent. But we also have this from Medical Express. Researchers detect malaria resistant to key drug in Africa. scientists have found evidence of a resistant form of malaria in Uganda, a worrying sign that the top drug used against the parasitic disease could ultimately be rendered useless without more action to stop its spread. Researchers in Uganda analyzed blood samples from patients treated with artemisinin, the primary medicine used for malaria in Africa, in combination with other drugs. They found that in 2019, nearly 20% of the samples had genetic mutations suggesting the treatment was ineffective. Lab tests showed it took much longer for those patients to get rid of the parasite that causes malaria. Drug-resistant forms of malaria were previously detected in Asia, and health officials have been nervously watching for any signs in Africa, which accounts for more than 90% of the world's malaria cases. Some isolated drug-resistant strains of malaria have previously been seen in Rwanda. The drug-resistant strains emerge in Uganda rather than being imported from elsewhere, they reported. Malaria is spread by mosquito bites and kills more than 400,000 people every year, mostly children under 5 and pregnant women. Dr. Phil Rosenthal, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, said that the new findings in Uganda, after past results in Rwanda, prove that resistance really now has a foothold in Africa. Rosenthal, who was not involved in the new study, said it was likely there was undetected drug resistance elsewhere on the continent. He said drug-resistant versions of malaria emerged in Cambodia years ago and have now spread across Asia. He predicted a similar path for the disease in Africa, with deadlier consequences given the burden of malaria on the continent. We basically rely on one drug for malaria, and now it's been hobbled. He suggested that instead of the standard approach, where one or two other drugs are used in combination with artemisinin, doctors should now use three, as is often done in treating tuberculosis and HIV. Public health officials need to act to stem drug-resistant malaria by beefing up surveillance and supporting research into new drugs, among other measures. We shouldn't wait until the fire is burning to do something, but that is not what generally happens in global health, he said, citing the failures to stop the coronavirus pandemic as an example. Okay, well, let's turn a little closer to home. This from Stat News. Advice shifting on aspirin use for preventing heart attacks. Older adults without heart disease shouldn't take daily low-dose aspirin to prevent a first heart attack or stroke, an influential health guidelines group said in preliminary updated advice. Bleeding risks for adults in their 60s and up who haven't had a heart attack or stroke outweigh any potential benefits from aspirin, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force said in its draft guidance. For the first time, the panel said there may be a small benefit for adults in their 40s who have no bleeding risks. For those in their 50s, the panel softened advice and said evidence of benefit is less clear. Aspirin use can cause serious harms and risk increases with age. Doctors have long recommended daily low-dose aspirin for many patients who already have had a heart attack or stroke. The task force guidance does not change that advice. Aspirin is best known as a pain reliever, but it is also a blood thinner that can reduce chances for blood clots. Aspirin also has risk, even at low doses, mainly bleeding in the digestive tract or ulcers, both of which can be life-threatening. Lauren Block, an internist researcher at Feinstein Institute for Medical Research in Manhasset, New York, said the guidance is important because so many adults take aspirin even though they have never had a heart attack or stroke. Okay, let's turn to a couple stories about children. First, from Medical Express, who's most likely to get bullied at school? Bullying remains a threat to American teens, and a new study reveals which kids may be at highest risk. Race-based bullying takes a heavy toll on teens, the research found, but minority kids who are picked on for other reasons, whether gender, sexual orientation, religion, disability, or immigration status, suffer a double whammy. Victims' physical and mental health suffer as their exposure to violence rises, according to a survey of high school students in Pennsylvania. They're also more likely to become violent themselves. Almost 10% of the students reported experiencing race-based bullying, and nearly 6% had bullied someone because of their race, the study found. Young people who were part of several stigmatized groups had even higher rates of bullying. The survey linked bullying with self-harm, suicidal thoughts, and greater involvement in violence. That included threatening or injuring someone else with a weapon, as well as fighting, sexual assault, intimate partner abuse, or experiencing the slaying of a friend or family member. Gender-diverse Black and Hispanic youth reported the highest rates of being bullied and of bullying, the survey found. This emphasizes the fact that these experiences of discrimination, including discrimination based on one's gender or sexual orientation, should really be incorporated and considered as parts of programs that address race-based discrimination. Okay, next up from Medical Express. More than one-third of children sleep less than recommended. Overall, 35% of children aged 4 months to 17 years sleep less than recommended for their age, according to research published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. The prevalence of short sleep duration varied from 31.2% among adolescents aged 13 and 17 years to 40.3% for infants aged 4 to 11 months. The likelihood of getting enough sleep was increased for persons aged 4 to 17 months if they had a regular bedtime. And another sleep-related story for us all from Medical Express. New research shows that brighter days make for better nights. A new study finds that more access to daylight at home improves circadian alignment, sleep, and mental health in healthy adults. Okay, well, we'll get towards the end of the show. I wanted to end with some longer, more general stories that have an impact on public health. This from Stat News. Corporate versus public control of science and technology, forging a framework for the 21st century. Science knows no country because knowledge belongs to humanity, Louis Pasteur said in 1876. Today it would be more accurate to say that science belongs to the corporations and investors that have the money, power, and savvy to secure patents and bring new developments to global markets, a change that threatens human and planetary health. As illustrated by the pharmaceutical industry's windfall profits, despite its failure to date to get COVID-19 vaccines to the poorest nations and the poorest in wealthy nations, Pasteur's observation that bringing science to the world is the highest personification of the nation now seems aspirational at best. The pandemic and the cascade of other global public health crises, including a climate emergency, increasing deaths of despair, growing burdens of chronic diseases and mental health problems, and the increasing toll of occupational and environmental exposures, demand a new accounting of the cost of the corporate control of science and technology in the 21st century. Here are just a few examples of how corporate control of scientific discoveries jeopardizes global health. The fossil fuel industry's misrepresentations of its own research on the perils of increased fossil fuel use and its active disruption of global efforts to mitigate the climate emergency blocks approval of measures to reverse its threat to planetary and individual health. The food industry's use of new technologies to make ultra-processed foods, along with its focus on products high in sugar, salt, fat, and a brew of chemicals, flavorings, and stabilizers, has created a default global diet that contributes to making diet-related disease the leading cause of premature death and preventable illnesses around the world. The food industry favors these highly processed products because they are more profitable than the healthier diets under which humans had evolved. Big pharmaceutical companies use new discoveries in biological and precision medicines to develop new drugs that generate huge profits, even though they help only a small proportion of those with cancer or other devastating diseases, and even if they divert scientific attention from developing drugs or vaccines that would benefit way more people. Unfortunately, other new technologies of the next few decades, artificial intelligence, precision agriculture, and the development of new medical devices and medical diagnostics, risk extending global health and social disasters if their deployment is controlled by corporations that value maximizing profit over promoting the public good. The coronavirus pandemic, rising public concern about global warming, the defeat of Donald Trump, and growing support for more progressive national priorities open new opportunities for rethinking the public policies that have allowed corporations to capture the use of science and technology for private gains. While most elected officials will continue to focus on short-term changes that could become regulations or laws in the next 2 years, advocates for more public-controlled science and medicine have an important opportunity to articulate a longer-term vision and agenda. Such a platform might package several ideas that until now have been discussed separately. Reforms of patent laws should strengthen the public's right to benefit from taxpayer-funded science, limit sole proprietary control of life-saving discoveries, expand compulsory licensing of essential medicines, and restrict patenting of biological materials. Industry has consistently exaggerated the benefits of the current corporate control of patenting and minimized the cost to public health of its control of science. Growing public control of intellectual property can help translate Pasteur's vision into practice. New approaches to negotiating multilateral and bilateral trade treaties can limit corporate use of new knowledge for private gain. Increasingly, trade and investment treaties privilege investors over governments and enable international corporations to bypass scientific evidence and challenge public health policies enacted through national democratic processes. Limiting the use of secret, corporate-controlled investor-state dispute settlement panels to resolve trade conflicts between governments and corporations that affect public health. Ending the use of trade treaties that enable indefinite extensions of exclusionary rights on patented medical products, a practice known as evergreening. And barring the use of trade agreements to block nations from regulating food and beverages that contribute to diet-related diseases could restore the capacity of national governments to use science to protect public health. Another key goal is to denormalize corporate misinformation and obfuscation campaigns. Following the playbook written by the fossil fuel and tobacco industries, behemoth food companies such as Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and others have funded research to downplay the role of sugary beverages in dietary diseases and promote physical activity instead. This misrepresentation has been used to defeat public health measures to reduce consumption of the products most associated with the global rise of obesity. By developing legal measures that make industries liable for the health costs of their disinformation campaigns, and by encouraging socially responsible investors to disinvest from companies and industries that misinform the public, science and public health advocates can build support for higher degrees of corporate accountability. Universities, scientific journals, and medical institutions can develop and enforce rules and organizational cultures that discourage financial conflicts of interest and sanction those who violate these norms. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted that public trust in and credibility of the scientific community form an essential foundation for effective public health programs. When researchers, clinicians, or public health agencies accept industry money to fund studies that corporate executives have designed, accept payments for prescribing certain products, or fail to disclose funding sources for their research, they diminish that trust and credibility, jeopardizing success in controlling future health crises. Strengthening democracy and limiting the political influence of private interests creates a more level playing field for public debates on science and technology. Reversing Citizens United and the Supreme Court decision that expands constitutional protection of free speech to corporations, blocking the revolving door between government and industry, and limiting the power of corporate lobbyists to preempt state and local public health regulations on food, pharmaceuticals, and firearms can help create a more level political playing field in which public interests can compete fairly with private ones. Are the public health crises of the last decade harbingers of a world doomed to declining human and planetary health, or a wake-up call to act now to create a better future? By advancing a comprehensive vision of a society in which the science and technology produced by humanity serve the public good rather than private interests, health professionals, researchers, and scientific organizations can contribute to a healthier, more equitable, and sustainable future. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up from the conversation on a big issue in health and public health, how placebos work is not fully understood, but alternative theory of consciousness holds some clues. If you've had both of your COVID vaccinations, you may have suffered some side effects, perhaps headaches, fatigue, fever, or a sore arm. These effects are mainly caused by your immune system's reaction to the vaccine. But most scientists agree there is another cause, the human mind. The ability of the mind to generate the symptoms of illness is known as the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is the unpopular twin brother of the placebo effect. Whereas the placebo effect alleviates pain and the symptoms of illness, the nocebo effect does the opposite. It generates pain and symptoms. A 2018 study found that almost half of participants in placebo trials experience side effects, even though they are taking inert substances. There was a similar finding in the first major trial of the Pfizer COVID vaccine in 2020. In the placebo group, who were not given the vaccine, between a quarter and a third of people reported fatigue. A similar number reported headaches, and around 10% reported muscle pain. Indeed, Martin Michaelis and Mark Wass, bioscientists at the University of Kent, recently suggested that, for some vaccinated people, the knowledge they have been vaccinated may be sufficient to drive side effects. Unlike its unpopular brother, the placebo effect is so well known that it needs little introduction. But in many ways, the placebo effect has become so familiar that it's easy to forget how strange it really is. It's bizarre that pain relief and healing can take place without actual treatment, and that powerful positive physiological effects can occur without any real physiological intervention. Research has shown that a vast array of different conditions benefit from placebos. This includes acne, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, ulcers, multiple sclerosis, rheumatism, Parkinson's disease, and colitis. A recent study also found that placebos had a highly significant effect on erectile dysfunction. Comparison of placebos to antidepressants suggests that the placebo effect can play an important role in the treatment of depression. A 2008 study found no significant difference between the leading antidepressants and placebos. In a 2018 study, antidepressants fared slightly better, but their effect was only found to be slightly or mostly modest compared with placebos. All of this isn't simply a matter of suggestion or delusion. Real and measurable physiological changes occur. Studies have found that when taken as painkillers, placebos decrease neurological activity related to pain and make use of many of the same neurotransmitters and neural pathways as opioids. Similarly, researchers have found that when taken by people with Parkinson's disease, placebos can stimulate the release of dopamine, which reduces the symptoms of the condition. Researchers looking into placebos have found that some factors, such as expectancy of treatment, different personality types, and the patient-physician relationship, can have some bearing on the effects. We also know that placebos can activate reward pathways in the brain and increase levels of opioid and dopamine activity. That said, the underlying causes of the placebo effect are still mysterious. Perhaps, though, nocebo and placebo effects only seem mysterious because we are looking at them from the wrong perspective. And by this, I mean maybe if we consider an alternative view of consciousness, the placebo and nocebo effect could begin to make more sense. In modern Western culture, the mind is usually seen as a byproduct of the brain, a kind of shadow cast by neurological processes. Mental phenomena such as thoughts, memories, and feelings are thought to be produced by brain activity. If we have psychological problems, they are thought to be due to neurological imbalances that can be corrected by medication. But if this assumption is correct, how is it possible for mental processes to influence the body as well as the brain in such a powerful way? Indeed, the difficulties of explaining consciousness purely in terms of brain processes have grown so acute that some philosophers and scientists have adopted an alternative view, that consciousness is not a direct product of the brain, but a fundamental universal quality, like mass or gravity. Other scientists and philosophers have adopted similar theories, which suggests that the mind or consciousness is a basic quality of material particles. More mainstream scientists still hope that a neurological explanation of consciousness will be found that will help throw some light on, quote, rogue phenomena like the nocebo and placebo effects. But taking the philosophical idea of consciousness as fundamental might suggest that the mind is in some way more powerful than the brain and the body, and so could influence the latter in a profound way, and it might help explain one day why placebo pills can bring about real physiological and neurological changes in many people. Okay, I want to close with the last of a trio of big think pieces, this one from Science Daily. The two cultures within science outlined. Researchers trace the outlines of two cultures within science, one of which promotes greater equity and inclusivity. In the world of scientific research today, there's a revolution going on. Over the last decade or so, scientists across many disciplines have been seeking to improve the workings of science and its methods. To do this, scientists are largely following one of two paths, the movement for reproducibility and the movement for open science. Both movements aim to create centralized archives for data, computer code, and other resources, but from there, the paths diverge. The movement for reproducibility calls on scientists to reproduce the results of past experiments to verify earlier results, while open science calls on scientists to share resources so that further research can build on what has been done, ask new questions, and advance science. Now, an international research team finds the two movements do more than diverge. They have very distinct cultures, with two distinct literatures produced by two groups of researchers with little crossover. Their investigation also suggests that one of the movements, open science, promotes greater equity, diversity, and inclusivity. Their findings were recently reported in the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences. The team of researchers on the study, whose fields range widely, from social psychology, network science, neuroscience, structural biology, biochemistry, statistics, business, and education, among others, were taken by surprise by the results. The two movements have very few crossovers, shared authors, or collaborations. They operate relatively independently, and this distinction between the two approaches are replicated across all scientific fields we examined. In other words, whether in biology, psychology, or physics, scientists working in the open science participate in a different scientific culture than those working within the reproducibility culture, even if they work in the same disciplinary field. And which culture a scientist works in determines a lot about access and participation, particularly for women. Cognitive science Richard Schifrin, who was previously involved in effort to improve science, but did not participate in the current study, says the new study provides a remarkable look into the way that current science operates. There are two quite distinct cultures, one more inclusive, that promotes transparency of reporting and open science, and another, less inclusive, that promotes reproducibility as a remedy to the current practice of science. A tale of two sciences. To investigate the fault lines between the two movements, the team first conducted a network analysis of papers published from 2010 to 2017, identified with one of the two movements. The analysis showed that even though both movements spanned widely across STEM fields, the authors within them occupy two largely distinct networks. Authors who publish open science research, in other words, rarely produce research within reproducibility, and very few reproducibility researchers conduct open science research. Next, they applied a semantic text analysis to the abstracts of the papers to determine the values implicit in the language used to define the research. Specifically, they looked at the degree to which the research was pro-social, that is, oriented towards helping others by seeking to solve large social problems. This is significant insofar as previous studies have shown that women often gravitate towards science that has more socially oriented goals and aims to improve the health and well-being of people and society. We found that open science has more pro-social language in its abstracts than reproducibility does. With respect to gender, the team found that women publish more often in high-status authorship positions in open science, and that participation in high-status authorship positions has been increasing over time in open science. While in reproducibility, women's participation in high-status authorship positions is decreasing over time. The researchers are careful to point out that the link they found between women and open science is so far a correlation, not necessarily a causal connection. It could be that more women join these movements, the science becomes more pro-social. But women could also be drawn to this pro-social model because that's what they value in science, which in turn strengthens the pro-social quality of open science. It's likely to be an iterative cultural cycle, which starts one way, attracts people who are attracted to that culture, and consequently further builds and supports that culture. These patterns might help open more doors to science. What we know from previous research is that when science conveys a more pro-social culture, it tends to attract not only more women, but also people of color and pro-socially oriented men. In this cultural moment of examining inequality throughout our institutions, looking at who gets to participate in science can yield great benefit. Trying to understand inequality in science has the potential to benefit society now more than ever. Understanding how the culture of science can compound problems of inequality or mitigate them could have a real advance in this moment when long-standing inequalities are being recognized and where there is momentum to act and create a more equitable science. Okay, well, lastly, we have 7 bonus articles, which you can read online. And you can also read the articles I've all covered online. I'll give you the link at the end. First up, pregnant and unvaccinated, Delta's deadly toll. 2, the AMA needs to declare a national mental health emergency. 3, the need for chemical simplification as a logical consequence of ever-increasing chemical pollution. The amount of new chemicals we're producing is outrunning our ability to assess them. 4, toxic algae blooms are multiplying. The government has no plan to help. 5, superhuman but never enough. Essay details inequities experienced by black women physicians in the U.S. In another medical doctor article, number 6, operating at a loss. Our healthcare system depends on physicians donating their times. Many people who work in healthcare will tell you that you have to spend a lot of extra hours, even after hours, personal unpaid time, to catch up with all the bureaucracy and notes and that type of thing. And lastly, 7, beyond just medical doctors, the U.S. deserves the best public health doctors. they needn't be medical doctors. A lot of states and a lot of large local health departments require that MDs be at the head of the departments, when in fact they may not be the best public health professionals to lead us. You can read these and all the other articles I've covered at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-